This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. We're going to listen back to a conversation recorded in front of a live audience at the WMFE studios last week. The conversation focused on reporting from 90.7's environmental reporter Amy Green in partnership with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, which explored the impact of climate change in Florida. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio tonight. We're also streaming live, as Steve mentioned, on Facebook, so you can join the conversation on Twitter. Use the hashtag ClimateChangeFL. As you may know, few states are more vulnerable than Florida to climate change, and yet the state's policy of denial has left residents on their own to face the risks. So 90.7 News partnered in 2018 with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and other public radio stations and journalists around the state on a year-long series exploring the issues. Here is 90.7's environmental reporter Amy Green in Yankeetown, Florida. It's a tiny coastal community focused on its natural environment in the face of sea level rise. We're joined on stage by 90.7's Amy Green, environmental reporter. Thank you so much for being here, Amy.
It's great to be here.
Also joining us on stage is Trevor Aronson. He's the executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and editor of the series. Trevor, thank you so much as well.
Thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Tristram Corton. He's a contributor to the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and an author who writes about climate change. Tristram, thank you for being here too.
Thank you.
And Dr. Randall Parkinson, research associate professor at Florida International University's Institute for Water and the Environment. Randall, thank you as well.
Great to be here.
Trevor, I want to start with you. Take us inside the series. It came along right as Florida was recovering from Hurricane Irma, and Governor Rick Scott, whose policy on climate change has been one of denial, was running on the Republican ticket to unseat Democratic Senator Bill Nelson. As we know, Scott defeated Nelson after a pretty close recount. Why did the Center for Investigative Reporting want to take climate change on in this in-depth way through this series of stories?
Yeah, so just to give you a little portrait of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, we are a nonprofit news organization that partners with other news organizations around the state, such as WMFE and the other NPR member stations, as well as the state's newspapers and other media. And our goal is not necessarily to compete head-to-head with other media organizations on stories that they do very well, but instead to try to use our modest resources to help invest in reporting that we think, for whatever reason, is being overlooked or deserves more scrutiny or more reporting resources in Florida. And for this year, we thought climate change, for last year's series, we thought climate change was an important topic to take on for really two reasons. And one of those reasons was in 2015, Tris Corton for FCIR reported a story that probably became our best known and continues to be our best known story, which was that Governor Rick Scott had basically banned the use of the term climate change and global warming in official communications. Tris will talk more about that, I'm sure. I mean, it was a story that really got worldwide attention. And at the same time, following Tris's reporting, there was story after story of, Miami is sinking, and the narrative about climate change in Florida was really just that. And then came, 2016 and, 2017, and we had Hurricane Irma, we had Hurricane Maria, we had these very powerful storms one after the other, and we just felt that the confluence of these things and the fact that climate change, at least in the news media as we were seeing it, was not getting the attention it deserved. And I think what we hope to do with the series by working with reporters like Amy and Tris was to try to explore climate change's effects in Florida and the kind of intersection between climate change and government inaction or government denial and what that really means. Like, what does climate change look like in Florida, and what does it mean that the state isn't taking as much of a leadership role as I think some critics would say, and what are the stories about those other than that, Miami is sinking? Because climate change is affecting the state in a myriad ways, and we wanted this series to kind of draw attention to that. And so what we did by working with reporters like Amy and Tris is reproduce radio stories, but then also worked with our newspaper partners like the Miami Herald and the Gannett Papers and others to try to give those stories audiences beyond where they normally would be heard. So in Amy's case, we could take one of her stories and expose it to a Miami audience that might not have heard it if WLRN didn't pick it up. And our goal was to try to give this reporting as much kind of exposure as we could, but also, in a concerted way, try to start a conversation around the state like this one about, what's happening with climate change in Florida and what the effects of, basically a policy of inaction have been.
Well, thanks for the kind of overview there, Trevor. As as you point out, it's kind of a complex issue, and it's hard to even really wrap your arms around it, even with a year-long series. But we can drill down a little bit to some of the reporting you've done, Amy Green. One of the towns you visited was Yankeetown. Tell us a little bit about what you found out from this community and how they're responding to the challenge of climate change.
Well, yeah, this is just a wonderful place, and if you ever have an opportunity to visit, I would strongly recommend it. It's in the Big Bend area of Florida. It's where the Withlacoochee River flows from central Florida into the Gulf of Mexico, and this snippet of the story that we heard at the beginning of the event, it was the story on Yankeetown, and Yankeetown is just a tiny little fishing village of just some 500 people. It's a community that lacks the resources and clout of places like Miami and things like that. And so what they have decided to do in the face of sea level rise is focus on natural resources as essential infrastructure that is economically important and physically protective against sea level rise. It's a very unique area in that it's very undeveloped. There's a wonderful place there called the Withlacoochee Gulf Preserve, where the University of Florida and other researchers have done a lot of research documenting sea level rise since the early 90s, which is quite rare, and it's a community where residents are not necessarily those who would be the most believing of climate change, but they can see what's happening right in front of them, and they can see that the sea level is getting higher and encroaching into their natural environment and causing their natural environment to change. And so the community took it upon themselves to do some mitigation studies, to do some planning, and they tapped into a state law that's aimed at vulnerable infrastructure, and they have used that to target planning around their natural resources.
So what are some of the things they've actually done to try and mitigate the impact of climate change?
Well, some examples of that would be, for instance, oyster beds or barrier islands that protect against storm surge during hurricanes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if we could dig into the science a little bit. Dr. Parkinson, talk to us about what you know and what the science is telling us. I mean, we got a couple of major scientific reports last fall on climate change. Tell us what the latest is on climate change and how to fix the state of Florida.
Let me just begin with my personal experience. I've been researching on sea level rise and climate change for over 35 years. And in the early and mid-'80s, coastal geologists like myself, we looked at the effects of sea level rise coming off of the last glacial maximum. So 15,000 years ago, sea level was 300 feet lower than today. All the water was in the ice. And as we moved into this relatively warm interglacial episode, sea level rose, just as it is now from melting water and thermal expansion of the surface of the ocean. And it melted really fast, so sea level rose very quickly, till about 3,000 years ago. About 3,000 years ago is when sea level essentially achieved equilibrium under the new climatic conditions, and it had remained more or less at the same elevation since then. So now we have, this is throughout the world, we have natural environments that are in equilibrium with a stable sea level, and we have human populations that are living along the coast in equilibrium with a stable sea level. This was in the early 80s and previous to that. In 1990 and in 1992, I read two articles that basically said by the end of this century, sea level will rise 3 feet. And given what I had known about the last several thousand years and beyond, I was stunned. It was like, not only is that an incredible magnitude compared to the last 3,000 years, but the rate at which sea level was rising would be devastating because it's faster than coral reefs can stay in the photic zone. It's faster than wetlands can keep in. It's just going to overstep and flood everything.
And this was a couple decades ago.
We knew this, and I actually researched and published on this as early, specifically on the impacts to the natural environment in 1993. I think scientists just sort of took it for granted that the information, as it always had, would sort of bubble up to people that were making policies and plans. And as the issue of climate change became a growing concern, and it was clear that that message wasn't getting out to the decision makers, most of the professional organizations, such as the American Geophysical Union or the United Geological Society of America, they took it upon themselves to establish standing committees and interns that went to D.C. and really tried to get this information out. That was quite successful beginning really in the 2000s, and we were making progress. But, of course, as you know now, scientists are, it's fake science. I mean, this issue that the scientific community is making this up for personal benefit is absurd, and certainly not for financial gain. I don't know anybody in science that is motivated by money, or they wouldn't be in science. So we've hit another roadblock here, and this one is, I don't know how we recover from this in the near future. We know that, as you pointed out, there's the IPCC report, which is an international report, and then the Global Change group here in the United States published another one. You know, things are just getting more and more bleak. I mentioned that paper from the 1990-1992, where the highest prediction of sea level by the end of the century was 3 feet. Well, now, you know, the minimum is 3 feet. You know, we're looking at 6, 7, 8, depending on how the, you know. It's the same with temperature. We've missed the 2-degree mark already, which is catastrophic. We are likely going to, right now, you know, the emissions gap is so huge, we're on our way to 6 degrees C by the end of this century.
I want to turn to you now, Tristram Courson. You flew into the center of Hurricane Michael for a story you wrote for the climate change series. And Tristram, what was it like bouncing around inside that plane?
It was intense. I mean, obviously it was intense. It was and breaking through that eye wall where the cloud cover was so dense, it was vertiginous. You couldn't tell up or down. It was just solid. And then you break into this. Like an epiphany, you know. You expect a choir of angels to start singing. The sun is streaming down. The sky is bright blue. So I'm going to back up just a little bit and say I had been on the hurricane beat for a little bit by then because, in fact, this trip came about because I was writing a book about a hurricane in 2015, Joaquin, that sank 2 cargo ships. From Florida. One, the El Faro, had left Jacksonville for Puerto Rico. The other, the Manouche, was headed from Miami to Haiti. Sank them both on the same day. On one ship, the El Faro, everybody died. On the other ship, the Manouche, everybody was rescued in a dramatic middle-of-the-night helicopter sortie where they dropped a rescue swimmer in the water. But this hurricane, Joaquin, took a very... It was very erratic in its track, and the National Hurricane Center could not accurately predict where it was going to go, and that was one of the problems. And it started outside the tropical latitudes, just barely outside the tropical latitudes, and went south instead of west, and it intensified very fast over water that was anomalously warm for that time of year, which we're seeing a lot of. So that's hurricane fuel. They power up quickly when they're over warm water. We have warm water, of course, because of climate change. So I spent time in the book writing about how climate change is impacting hurricanes. And that led to this fascination with hurricanes. In fact, an entire chapter was written as I had evacuated my family from Irma. We went to my wife works in a hospital, so we went to this hospital. They wouldn't take our dog, so I took the dog up into a car park, car garage, about, you know, and I parked it up above. And I looked around, and I was like, this is pretty solid in here. I think I'll just hang out here with the dog. Because I was writing about hurricanes, and I wanted to experience it firsthand. And indeed, I saw it come, and the bands coming in, and I parked right up at the edge, and we got doused by the rain, and you could sort of feel it viscerally as I was writing about these poor guys who died in a hurricane. So I'm a little far gone in the hurricane thing. But the in terms of where it fits into this series, right, this is a huge threat to us. The science and the modeling indicates the storms are going to be stronger. The trajectory is that they're going to be reaching wind speeds of historic levels, meaning we haven't reached them yet. There are all kinds of interesting things coming out in the studies. The guiding air currents for hurricanes seem to be shifting or weakening so that the tracks are going to get wobbly, and you won't, again, that will be a challenge on predicting where exactly they're going to go. Hurricanes are tracking further south than they ever have before.
If you could take us back in time a little bit, I mean, several years ago, as Trevor mentioned, you broke that story for the Center for Investigative Reporting about the use of the phrase climate change and other kind of associated words, and how that was kind of something you couldn't say in the administration, the gubernatorial administration at the time. How does that sort of fit into the history of environmental policy in Florida?
Oh, my God. It was so heartbreaking. So we do this story in which a guy came up to us and said he wanted to volunteer on a coral reef education program through the DEP, and they told them at this briefing don't bring up climate change, and so he was mad about that, and he came to us and said, they're telling me I can't talk about climate change. And they even sent me an email. I said, let me see the email. And I remember looking at it and thinking, it looks like they're kind of being ordered they're being ordered to tell these people not to bring this up. And we looked into it, and we found lots of employees who said that, yes, in fact, they were ordered not to use the terms climate change or sea level rise or
global warming as well, right?
Global warming, yeah. So we write this story, or a series of stories, and it blows up, gets very big. You've made it when the late night comedy shows are riffing on your material, and it's like, oh. What happened as a result of that? It was right around a little bit later, around the Paris Climate Accord meeting. Foreign journalists would come and talk to me, interview me, because it was this ludicrous situation here. And at the end, every time they interviewed me, at the end, I would ask them, so in your country, do you have an organized lobby of climate change deniers? And they were like, no. And at one point, I was in a room with the State Department had been talking to a bunch of energy officials from developing nations. I mean, developing, like Poland was there, and Malta, and some African countries. And I asked the same question, and they said, no. Not even in Poland, where they have all the coal miners. And that has always struck me, that we're the most powerful, the most influential country when it comes to this, and there's just something about our psyche or the way we've been manipulated by powerful interests to have this occurring.
Amy Green, I wonder if I could bring you back into the conversation. I mean, thinking about what's happening at the state level, we've heard a lot from the new governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, on the toxic algae problem and what he wants to do with cleaning up the waterways. But what about climate change? What are we hearing from Governor DeSantis on that issue?
Right. So Governor DeSantis, toxic algae was a very central component of his campaign. And only a few days after he took office, he unveiled this very sweeping environmental plan on the issue of toxic algae and water quality. And as part of that, He announced that he would establish an office for coastal resiliency. I can't remember the precise name for the office, but this would be something that would be located in the executive office, and it would put funding and technical expertise toward sea level rise. This was a component of this broader plan that has been extremely well received by the environmental groups, but some of the criticism has been obviously that while we are seeing this attention on sea level rise, which is a welcome change from the Scott administration and the absence of leadership there on this important issue, what we're not seeing is any attention on climate change and any attention on addressing emissions.
That was part of a conversation recorded in front of a live audience at the WMFE studios last week. We heard from 90.7 environmental reporter Amy Green, Trevor Aronson with the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, author and journalist Tristram Corton, and FIU research professor Dr. Randall Parkinson. You can find more of Amy Green's reporting on our website, wmfe.org. Still to come, the University of Central Florida regroups after President Dale Whitaker's resignation last week over misspent construction money.
The room was packed with a lot of employees, alumni, students, supporters of the university. A lot of the people that came out to speak were very, very supportive of Dr. Whitaker. A lot of them even urged the Board of Trustees not to accept his resignation.
So what's next for the university? Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The University of Central Florida Board of Trustees accepted the resignation of President Dale Whitaker last week. From the Education Desk, we take a closer look at the fallout from the misspent money that led to his resignation and what comes next. We're joined by Annie Martin, who covers higher education with the Orlando Sentinel. Annie, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by 90.7's Abe Abariah, who's been following the story. Abe, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Abe, I want to start with you. Just remind us what happened last week with the resignation of Dale Whitaker. This was just the latest step in this unfolding drama over how the university paid for Trevor Colburn Hall.
Yeah, absolutely. So this whole thing started with Trevor Colburn Hall, which was sort of a replacement to the older Colburn Hall, which was built in the 70s. And this was a project that the university spent $38 million on. And what has sort of come about in the last year was that the university was using what's called E&G carry forward funds. So these are dollars that are given by the legislature for operations. And when they're not spent, they sort of roll over. And there was a Board of Governors regulation that was pretty clear about how, you know, this money can only be used for those particular types of services and can't be used for new construction in particular. It's pretty explicit about that. So when all this sort of came out last year, what ended up happening was Bill Merck, who was the chief financial officer at the time, resigned, took responsibility for it. And the university started an investigation. They hired an outside law firm. In the meantime, the Board of Governors, which oversees the state university, started their own investigation, as well as the House Ethics Committee. And so what we saw from this was it wasn't just Trevor Colburn Hall. It was there was another $12, $13 million that was misspent using the same type of money. And overall, including Colburn Hall and the other projects, was about $85 million that the university either misspent or planned to misspend using these dollars. So after Merck resigned, the investigation that the university paid for wrapped up. And in addition to Bill Merck, there were four other university officials, administration officials underneath Bill Merck who were fired. Fast forward now to the legislative session sort of cooking up to start on March 5th. And we've had not just these four individuals who were fired, but now we've had the board chairman, Marcos Marchena, who resigned. And this sort of culminated last week with Dale Whitaker, whose resignation came out last Tuesday.
Annie Martin, you were in the Board of Trustees meeting last week. It was a pretty emotional meeting. Whitaker obviously has quite a bit of support from staff and students. Give us a sense of what that meeting was like and what came out of it.
It was very emotional. The room was packed with a lot of employees, alumni, students, supporters of the university. There was more than an hour of public comment leading up to the vote to accept Dr. Whitaker's resignation. And a lot of the people that came out to speak were very, very supportive of Dr. Whitaker. And a lot of them even urged the Board of Trustees not to accept his resignation. Dr. Whitaker's wife and daughter got up and spoke and talked about how it had been so hurtful that Dr. Whitaker's character had been under attack during all this controversy, and they thanked the students for coming out and supporting him. The comments from the trustees before they made their vote were interesting as well. A lot of them seemed to allude to a force at play that was pushing Dr. Whitaker out the door. They felt like they had to accept his resignation, even if they didn't want to. In fact, one of the trustees who voted against accepting the resignation, John Sprowls, suggested that doing so might even cost him his seat on the board. He told the others, "I'm really torn between what's right and what's best for the university. I know that it's my role, and if by this vote it means I should no longer be on the Board of Trustees, I'd be happy to have that conversation." There was a lot of discussion leading up to the vote and a lot of feeling like, you know, the university was losing a great leader in Dr. Whitaker.
What can you tell us about what Dr. Whitaker hoped would happen with his resignation? What do you think that achieves from his point of view?
Well, he wrote in his letter that he hoped that by resigning, he would end punitive measures and threats against the university. And he actually included a list of things that he hoped the Board of Governors, which oversees the state university system, as well as Governor Ron DeSantis and the legislature would do after he resigned. And some of those things involved allowing university projects that had been put on hold during this investigation to go forward. He also said he wanted them to express their support for the Board of Trustees at the university and that he didn't want the legislature to hold it against the university when it came to funding for UCF during the coming session. So I thought that was really interesting that he said, yes, I'm resigning, but there's also some things that I would like from, you know, lawmakers and others in the state to help repair the relationship between UCF and the Tallahassee and the Board of Governors.
Mm-hmm. Essentially kind of a wish list as well as a resignation letter?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one way you could look at it was he has a lot of goodwill among students and among the board members. And I think one way, if you were to sort of look at this purely political, he was maybe trying to cash in on some of that goodwill and sort of help out the university on his way out. And one of the things I, you know, we were looking through the, you know, his termination agreement. And so he, you know, by his resignation, he still will get 85% of his salary for 9 months. Then he'll get, you know, basically another 3 month severance package at the end. So he's looking at, you know, even though he has resigned, he will, you know, still collect about $430,000 over the next year while he's presumably looking for another position.
So, Annie, I wonder if we could go back to that trove of documents that was released by the legislative committee that was looking into this misspent money. What did that tell us?
Well, there was a lot of information in those documents, hundreds and hundreds of pages. But as my colleagues and I looked through them, one of the themes that emerged was that Dr. Whitaker knew more about the misspending than he let on. There were definitely several former and current employees who felt like he hadn't come forward and accepted his role in that, which was interesting because, you know, I interviewed Bill Merck, who you talked about earlier, back in December. And, you know, that was kind of his point that, yes, he had taken responsibility for the mistake, but there were other people involved as well. And in fact, former president of the university, John Hitt, wrote a letter to the law firm that was investigating the matter for UCF saying that, you know, yes, Dr. Whitaker had been involved in the decision to use leftover operating funds on a new building. And it was interesting to me that that was a theme that really emerged in the depositions as well from the current and former employees.
UCF isn't the only university that's facing scrutiny over how it spends money on buildings and other things. Abe Abariah, what other schools might be now thinking about that and maybe a little bit worried in light of what's happened here at the University of Central Florida?
Well, we've seen the Board of Governors put out pretty strict letters to all the universities in the system saying, you know, we want you to go back through and basically look for any of the same type of misspending. What we found, you know, originally when this first started happening was University of South Florida in Tampa has talked about having a few million dollars that was misspent. And over the weekend, it came out as well that the University of Florida has some misspending. Kind of going back to the deposition question, too, I think what is interesting, too, is some of the timing on this. So those depositions were released by the Florida House a few hours after Whitaker's resignation was accepted by the board. Mm-hmm. But the one deposition that has not come out yet is Dale Whitaker's deposition. So there may still be more to come on this. So we're going to be kind of keeping an eye out for it.
So what's next for UCF?
Well, you know, this legislative session is obviously going to be an interesting one. The university did appoint Thad Seymour as the interim president of the university. So if he's going to continue in that role more than just sort of, you know, in the meantime, he will have to go before the Board of Governors to get approval. The university is going to have to basically restart the entire process for getting a new president, maybe a bit more long term, which can involve a search committee. It is a lengthy process. And, you know, it's worth mentioning, you know, a lot of these university presidents, they're not in the role for 3 to 5 years. You know, this could be, you know, in John Hitt's case, it was a 25-year tenure. And mm-hmm. I think that the university probably would like to keep going that route of obviously this situation with Dale Whitaker is a bit more unique, but you know, I think that they are looking for a long-term person who can continue to have those relationships with the governor, the senators, the legislature, regardless of the turnover in those positions. More broadly, too, August, the University of Central Florida's downtown campus is going to open, which is going to be, you know, something that's been in the works for years now. Like I said, it's going to be interesting to see whether or not some of these funding issues they're talking about in the legislature get resolved, if there's any impact to the budgets, and you know, more broadly, whether there are changes to the university system that maybe will affect how capital projects go forward. One of the things that's sort of, I guess, a bit of a pet peeve for me as well, the state used to fund capital projects from a massive pot of money called Public Education Capital Outlay. That fund has dropped significantly. So even more broadly, there's these questions about how the universities and how the legislature is going to fund building mm-hmm. at across the state university systems and across all public education. So I think some of those bigger questions like that are still going to be left up in the air for the foreseeable future.
Annie Martin, how do you see this episode with UCF affecting the way other universities interact with the legislature? Or I'm wondering if there's anything in this which kind of tells you something about the relationship that there may be between this particular legislature and universities this year at least.
I don't know. You know, I think that's something that we're going to have to wait and see. I did talk with several lawmakers last week, especially those from Central Florida, about this issue. And they said that they hoped that this would not impact UCF in the long run. They didn't want to see universities funding penalized for a mistake like this. But the House Committee on Public Integrity and Ethics is still investigating this issue at UCF. And I think that will show other universities you can't swap out one form of state funding for another. And I think that will, you know, certainly serve as an example for other institutions about, you know, the way that they handle their state funding.
Annie Martin is a reporter with the Orlando Sentinel covering higher education. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by 90.7's Abe Abariah. Abe, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Still to come, the art of the Harlem Renaissance on display at the DeLand Museum of Art.
She moved to New York and she said, you know, my students and the students that I've taught, those are my legacy.
Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Harlem Renaissance was a time of great artistic and cultural expression for African-American artists, musicians, and intellectuals. Museum of Art DeLand Curator of Education Pam Kaufman says they laid the foundation for the Civil Rights era decades later. I spoke to Kaufman at the museum where a collection of artworks from the Harlem Renaissance is on display, including sculptures and paintings from Florida artists.
This exhibition is really something very special. It is a very comprehensive exhibition of African-American artists, 19th and 20th century, that really were pulled from the Harlem Renaissance era. That's the focus of the show. We have artists that were post-Harlem Renaissance, but it's really about the Harlem Renaissance artist and all of those people that were involved in the Harlem Renaissance and really got it started. The Harlem Renaissance was really a part of the Great Migration, which was what happened post-World War I, when there were so many jobs that needed to be filled in the North. So there was a migration from African Americans, mainly in the South, but from other areas, that moved to the North, mostly New York, but that was also in Chicago. And the Great Migration and the Harlem Renaissance really lasted for about a decade. The time frame is questionable because there wasn't a set time frame, but it really started about 1919 and went through the great stock market crash. And it was a point in time when so many African Americans just came together in the Harlem area in New York. And it wasn't just visual artists. It was writers like Langston Hughes and County Cullen. It was performers. It was intellectuals like W.E. Du Bois and Elaine Locke. All these people that came together and created this whole Renaissance era. It was a great coming together of all of this art and music and a time for African Americans to really show that they were not less than or other, that they were equal to the white America that hadn't really been able to be done before because of segregation, slavery, and all of those things.
So tell us about this piece here by Augusta Savage. Okay.
Augusta Savage was a Florida artist, as a matter of fact. She was born in Green Cove Springs. She really had a difficult time as a young child. She loved to work with clay. And her father was a minister, a Methodist minister, who didn't believe in graven images. So Augusta said at one point when she was little, she said her father about whooped the art out of her because he would usually spank her multiple times a week for making the things. But she went on to make art. Her family moved to Palm Beach later when she was about 15. And she started going to school there. And she was making sculptures, and the principal of her high school realized how good she was, and he actually began to pay her to teach the other students sculpture. So anyway, she did struggle a lot. This piece in particular, which is called Lift Every Voice and Sing, was commissioned for the 1939 World's Fair. It took her 2 years to do. The actual sculpture was 16 feet tall.
And where is that now? Is it in New York?
No, and what happened was it was destroyed. She worked on it, for 2 years, and the commission was for her to make a piece of art that represented African-American music. So she chose this piece. The poem by Johnson was what inspired her. It was the most viewed piece, the most loved piece during the World's Fair, and it was built in plaster, or she created, sculpted it in plaster because she didn't have the money for bronze. They tried to get someone to fund having it cast in bronze, but no one would. So after the World's Fair, the piece was destroyed.
What a tragedy.
It was. I mean, because this was an amazing piece of work, and to be done in plaster on top of it. So what we have here is a replica. She did make some replicas smaller in metal. And so I think there are probably, I was looking on the registry for auctions pieces, and they said there's maybe about 19 or so left. So the pieces now are really quite valuable. But what was really sad was she couldn't make a go of her art. She was a teacher, and that's what she really did. And she said later, when she quit making art, she moved to New York later in her career because it just things didn't work. But she moved to New York, and she said, you know, my students and the students that I've taught, those are my legacy, that she helped other artists. She was important to the Harlem Renaissance, though, because she did do that. She had a studio in Harlem, and Jacob Lawrence and Romare Bearden and other artists that were so important to the Renaissance came to her studio, and she sort of mentored them, and she gave them a space. So she really was instrumental in setting up other artists for the Harlem Renaissance.
Pam Kaufman, you want to show us some other pieces?
Sure. We can look at this piece, if you want, by Faith Ringgold. This is one of the pieces that's been on a lot of our promotional work, our promotional pieces for the show. Faith Ringgold was really kind of post-Harlem Renaissance, her work during that time, but she was living in Harlem during the Renaissance time period. And her home was a place where everybody came. Her parents were very involved in the art scene and the whole intellectual New Negro movement. So, you know, Duke Ellington would come and Langston Hughes would come. So she was exposed to that. And her mother was a fashion designer. And her father was very involved in music and other things, and he was a great storyteller. So Faith was a child, but growing up in all of that time and exposed to that. She went to school. It was really interesting because when she went to school in New York or applied for art school, she couldn't go. Not because she was black, but because she was a woman and only guys were allowed to go to the art program. So she went to education, to art education. And she learned sewing from her mother and her grandmother, who was very involved with the quilting tradition from African-American slave unit. And her great-grandmother had been a slave, so she had taught her grandmother the quilting tradition. So Faith is really well known for her story quilts, which is what we have here in this piece. And then also the Tar Beach piece, which we have over here. The Tar Beach piece, she did a whole series of quilts on Tar Beach. And one of the people who was in the publishing industry saw them, said, this should be a book. So that started her whole career in children's books. And so she did the Tar Beach book, and she's written many, many children's books, which we have some in here that you can see, but she's a well-known children's author. She was also very involved in the feminist art movement in the 70s. She is a professor. She has been many, many different things, and her work has evolved over time. But her story quilts are some of her best-known pieces. People kind of know her for that. So she's another very important figure who continued the legacy of the people in the that started in the Harlem Renaissance era.
Which pieces have gotten the biggest reaction or are most popular with viewers so far?
You know, it's been interesting because so many people haven't seen this work, yet everybody we have in this exhibition were important people and really well-known artists in the Harlem Renaissance. I think a lot of people are drawn to this Faith Ringgold piece because it's colorful, it's big, it's bright, it's a quilt, it's something they understand. A lot of people from Florida like the Augusta Savage work because of the Florida connection with it too. We also have the Romare Bearden pieces, and who was another prominent artist in the Harlem Renaissance. And then Jacob Lawrence as well. He was also an important artist in the Harlem Renaissance. So those are names people know. If you say Harlem Renaissance and they know about that period and the artists, those are artists that they know. So they're really drawn to those. I think a lot of people like the Amina Robinson pieces because they're just so vibrant and colorful, those four up there.
Yeah, let's take a closer look.
Sure. So Amina Robinson was really an interesting artist. She was pretty much, her father taught her how to work with paper and work with books. So she did a lot of books and she did a lot of art. But her father was really encouraging of her. Her mother was a seamstress, so her mother taught her to sew. She was really encouraged and taught and mentored by her father and her mother. So she had a lot of the traditional things. One of the things that I think was really interesting was her father taught her to make this mixture that they called hogmog, which was unique, and it was clay and mud and leaves and twigs and fibers and dye and lye and dyes and all of this different stuff that she put together, and she used it to make sculptures with. She also used it in her two-dimensional work. The four pieces that we have here in this exhibition were pieces that she did a whole series of works on famous African Americans from a historical perspective. So she did people that were instrumental in various African American movements, not just art, but in music and writing and all of this. And so we have these pieces that, like Maya Angelou and Clementine Hunter, who was an artist, and Edmona Lewis, who was a very important artist in the Harlem Renaissance, and Mary Birchfield, who was a fiber artist. So I think these are just so vibrant. And they really show one part of her work. But she was very diverse in her work. She made altered books, she made sculptures, she made all sorts of things. But this kind of represents one series that she did in her work of African-American historical figures. Mm-hmm.
The sculpture we were looking at first, that is not the only piece by a Florida artist, right? You've got other pieces by artists who grew up in Florida or learned their craft in Florida.
Absolutely. There's some other artists in this exhibition who have Florida associations, but downstairs in our gallery down there, we have another exhibition, and it's by Purvis Young. Purvis Young was an artist who was born in Liberty City, and he grew up and lived in Overtown and spent his life in Overtown. And the main reason we're pairing that show with the African-American show we have here is that during the Harlem Renaissance era, so many of the artists that were performing in New York, especially the jazz musicians and the entertainers, would come to Miami Beach to perform. But they couldn't stay in Miami because they were black. So they would go to Overtown and stay in Overtown and perform. So Overtown sort of got the reputation of being the Harlem of the South. And Purvis's work was really all about Overtown. And it was his community. And he was talking about what it was like everyday life in Overtown, but also the destruction of Overtown when 395 came through. And when they built 395, it literally destroyed the community. And so his work, in a way, is protest art, protesting what happened to the community, the people, and everything. So it's a different. He's not a Harlem Renaissance artist, but his work really ties in with what's going on here, because there is that connection and is that Florida connection, which a lot of people didn't realize, that, you know, the artists from Harlem would come down and perform in Miami area.
Did any of them come down and exhibit here in Florida too?
No.
The visual artists?
Not really, because what happened was there weren't many places for them to show. So there was a foundation called the Harmon Foundation, and the Harmon Foundation really promoted African-American art during the Harlem Renaissance. It was the major place that African-American artists got to show, because there was such limited opportunities for them. And in fact, some of these artists would have their work in museums or galleries, but they couldn't go to the gallery because they were black, and because of the black codes and the Jim Crow laws, they weren't allowed to go into the galleries where their work was hanging. So the Harmon Foundation really gave them an opportunity. They had exhibitions, they had traveling shows, they had competitions. They tried to sell the work, but unfortunately, most of it didn't sell. So when the Harmon Foundation actually dissolved, they gave a lot of the work to different museums and universities, and that's why so much of the work is still out there, because a lot of it just didn't sell, and it just probably would have never made it to university galleries or museums. So the Harmon Foundation was responsible for that and giving the work to places so it could have some kind of longevity.
What do you want people to take away from this exhibition?
I want them to come and just realize what a great plethora of artists that were available, and the talent that was out there, and the connection, the historical connection to what was happening at that time period, and see artists that they might never see, and learn about artists that they might not have known about, and realize that there was a great legacy. And the other thing I want people to understand is that had it not been for the Harlem Renaissance, the whole civil rights movement might not have happened when it did. I'm not saying it wouldn't have happened, but the artists, the intellectuals, the poets, everyone that was involved in the Harlem Renaissance really set the stage for the civil rights movement, and it was the impetus that pushed it forward. And I think had it not been for that time period, you know, we wouldn't have seen the civil rights movement when we did.
Well, Pam Kaufman is the curator of education with the Museum of Art and DeLand. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us, and we hope people will come and see the show. It's up through March 17th, so come and visit us and see the work.
Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 is supported by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. You can follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.